Haiti entered the media spotlight last year due to an earthquake that caused unprecedented carnage for this country. Upwards of 200,000 Haitians were killed, over 2 million left homeless, and are now living in internally displaced persons camps. This past October, an outbreak of cholera began, killing more than 4,500 people. Today on the Health Justice Radio Collective, we speak with Policy and Advocacy Director of Partners in Health, Donna Berry, on Haitian healthcare given these circumstances. After the interview, I'll be briefly discussing the structural constraints impeding Haitian progression across all sectors, including healthcare, and the role Canada and the rest of the international community have played in fostering underdevelopment. Thanks for tuning in to 93.3 CFMU and enjoy today's show.
Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Thanks for tuning in to Health Justice Radio Collective. My name is Riaz Sayani-Malchi, and I'm speaking with Donna Berry, the Advocacy and Policy Director of Partners in Health. Welcome to the show, Donna.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about Partners in Health. So, Donna, would you be able to explain for our listeners what Partners in Health is?
Sure. We are a nonprofit organization based in Boston, Massachusetts, and we have been in existence for about 25 years. We work in 12 countries around the world to help build health systems and treat patients alongside our in-country colleagues for really providing comprehensive health care services for everyone. While we may be known best sometimes for our work with HIV or MDR, multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, mm-hmm. we do treat a wide range of conditions and help strengthen health systems in the countries where we work. We started our work originally nearly 25 years ago in Haiti, and that mm-hmm. is by far and away our largest project. We have about 13,000 staff worldwide, of which nearly 7,000 are community health workers. And so they come from the communities where we're providing care and are really our extension into the communities to help provide care in the communities as well as get patients in for care into clinics and hospitals when they need it.
Wow, that's quite something. So I guess you could say Partners in Health is pretty different than other NGOs around the world that provide health services.
I think we do feel like we have a unique model in that we try to bridge from the community to the tertiary healthcare center mm-hmm. and really have a strong community outreach program that, you know, is based on the community health workers that I mentioned.
Yeah.
I think also our focus on building and strengthening the systems in the countries in which we work is also not entirely unique to us. There are some other organizations who do some of that. But out of, I think it's now 60 different facilities in which we work around the world, mm-hmm. 58 of them are part of the public sector health systems in the countries where we work. So we're really trying to build up the systems and strengthen the existing systems of care rather than duplicating services
and
creating independent systems.
Yeah, so I guess you'd say you guys, I guess, focus more on the sustainability aspect mm-hmm. of healthcare. That's really great to hear. Mm-hmm. So, as you said, Partners in Health actually began in Haiti. Could you give maybe like a really brief overview of how that happened and maybe what the state of Haitian healthcare is, or was, I guess, when Partners in Health started and where it is today?
Sure. The health system in Haiti has been chronically underfunded for decades mm-hmm. and for varying reasons. And it's been particularly, I think, starved in the rural areas. So Dr. Paul Farmer, who's one of our founders, mm-hmm. and Ophelia Dahl met each other in the Central Plateau of Haiti, which is one of the most rural, remote areas in the country, about 25 years ago. And they asked the community at that time, sort of, what do you need? And they said, you know, we want a hospital, we want clinics, we want health care. Mm-hmm. And so we've really taken that on as a mission to expand into, I think we're up to 12 different clinics and hospitals within the Central Plateau and now into the lower Antipony, and really to build up the systems there. There are other organizations and other institutions working in Haiti to help in other regions, not where we're working. But we do partner with some in the areas where we work. I think a lot of organizations that are working there don't have the luxury of having what we call unrestricted funding at Partners in Health, which allows us to really provide what it is the communities are asking for. Sometimes a lot of the other organizations that are working there are required to do what it is their grant is telling them to do. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, it's always needed. It just may not be the top priority of the community. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. But I do think that, I'm sorry I don't have budget numbers in front of me, but I know one of the things that we often quote is that the Ministry of Health's budget in Haiti is less than the operating budget for Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is one of the largest hospitals here in the Boston area. Mm-hmm. But when you take that into consideration, the metro population of the Boston area is only around 1 million people, and Haiti's a country of 10 million at least. And to have an operating budget that's less than just simply one hospital in Massachusetts is really a sad state of affairs. I think what we find another huge issue with Haiti is also the severe shortage of healthcare workers, which has gotten worse since the earthquake. They have some of the worst nurse and doctor to population ratios anywhere in the world, partially because there's not enough training capacity in the country itself, but also due to a lot of brain drain. We actually have, unfortunately, and I mean fortunately for the U.S. And Canada, we have a lot of Haitian doctors and nurses serving in our healthcare system here, and it's also related to the conditions in which the health professionals have to work in Haiti. Sorry, not only do they have low salaries, they often don't have the tools with which to do their trade, to provide the best care. And so we're really pleased that, honestly, we have it's serving clinically in the hospitals and clinics where we're working. There are no full-time expatriates working there, no full-time Americans or others. While they may be there in advisory capacities for different programs, the people who are providing the care in the clinics and hospitals where we work are all Haitians. But we're able to, through our fundraising and our efforts, offer, somewhat better salaries, not extremely higher than the Ministry of Health salaries, but better, but also provide the tools, the labs, the lab tests, the medications, the other diagnostic equipment like x-rays and other equipment that people, need to actually feel like they're providing good care to the citizens that they're serving.
Exactly. You brought up the earthquake in Haiti last year. Could you maybe describe, just for our listeners, the level of humanitarian catastrophe that earthquake was for the Haitian population and how Partners in Health responded to that natural disaster?
Sure, thanks. I think all of us have heard that it is possibly the worst, humanitarian crisis that any of us that are alive have seen today. The estimates are from somewhere between 260 and 330,000 people perished. Mm-hmm. And then there were hundreds of thousands of other people who were injured and traumatized by the quake. And then you also, to date, still have somewhere around 1 million people who are displaced and living outside of, the homes in which they were living before the earthquake. What Partners in Health did, one of the great things about having such a large Haitian staff outside of the capital was that we were able to rapidly mobilize teams to go into Port-au-Prince to start providing the emergency care. A bunch of our doctors and nurses and other health workers went to Port-au-Prince to help just set up, makeshift triage points to get people into care at any of the sites where we had surgical capacity and an operating room capacity. We did a lot of surgeries and in general care for those who were injured. We did mobilize, I'm forgetting, but I want to say it's over around 600 volunteers to go down in teams over about 8 months to provide care to the patients as well, something that we typically don't do, but in this instance we really needed to have short-term volunteers down there helping out, providing the services. And so we, with the request of the Ministry of Health, once people had resettled into some of the camps in Port-au-Prince, did set up four primary care clinics in four different locations. We're now down to three, but we're still providing primary care to patients in one of the largest camps in Port-au-Prince and then two smaller ones, and also totally Haitian-staffed and run. I think two problems that we noticed, we alongside our Haitian colleagues noticed that were, just laid bare the two areas that of healthcare that have been sorely neglected in Haiti. One obviously is surgical and orthopedic care, and how there unfortunately is not enough local capacity to provide all the care that certainly the people needed in that urgent situation, but also even the follow-up care at this time. So we've been trying to also strengthen the surgical and orthopedic rehabilitation services out at our sites as well as with referrals in the camps. Mm-hmm. And then the other huge issue that was noted that we had already started addressing in some places where we were working in Haiti, but not everywhere, was mental health. And so we've really tried to expand our services in mental health to, involve community health workers, social workers, and to some extent doctors and nurses. There's just not enough to go around. But we really have been doing a ton of community outreach, both in the camps and in the sites where we work, just for community health workers to raise awareness about common mental health conditions, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disease or syndrome. It's an area of healthcare that's kind of neglected worldwide, but has been particularly neglected in Haiti. And given how much trauma, emotional, spiritual, mental trauma that everyone experienced with this huge catastrophe, the needs just skyrocketed. So we've really tried to strengthen our services in that area as well.
Well, yeah, that no one can deny that the Haitian populace has faced so much, even just in the last decade. It's unbelievable. But they are very resilient people. One of my colleagues was actually in Haiti this past summer doing work in the camps, and he said the one thing that everyone noticed is the strength of the Haitian spirit. I had another question. I wanted to ask you about the recent cholera outbreak and how Partners in Health have responded to that.
Sure. So we actually were working in the town or city that saw the first massive amount of cases in Saint-Marc in the lower Artibonite. We have been supporting a hospital and primary care clinic there, as well as one that's not too far away in Petite Rivière. And both of those were actually part of the initial outbreak. And because cholera had not been present in Haiti for at least five decades, if not longer, and because we, as an organization, Partners in Health, have never worked in a country where it's endemic or epidemic, for that matter, we had a huge learning curve to get up to speed to provide the best care available. But it was clear from the outset that that's likely what this outbreak was, and so our Haitian colleagues and other health team members who were down there, scrambled to start providing rehydration and treatment and also a huge community outreach component with community health workers out into the most remote areas to get people up to speed and aware of the earliest signs and symptoms of the disease. So by this point in time, how many months later? 5 months later. Obviously, the disease has spread to every corner of the country. And there's clearly some areas that have not yet been as deeply affected as the initial spots were. And, the mortality rate has stabilized to under 1%, at least in clinics and hospitals. Mm-hmm. It's possible that it's still higher out in remote areas where people have not yet been outreached to with community education, etc. We helped in cholera, sort of public health terminology. There are types of centers and units that you set up. You set up cholera treatment units as a sort of first-line referral point, and then cholera treatment centers, which are the ones which actually have beds in them. So we, at the height of the epidemic, I think had cholera treatment centers in, I want to say, five locations in the Central Plateau, mm-hmm. and the Artibonite, maybe even six, and then also one at the largest camp in Port-au-Prince where we were working. We had the cholera treatment units at every single other site where we were working, so more as a sort of primary referral point. And it's just based on the severity of cases that are presenting and the number of cases that are presenting as to where, you know, what type of unit you set up and if you need to. One of the most important things in cholera to do, because it's so infectious, is to set up a completely separate facility, whether it's a tent or some sort of temporary structure or taking over some sort of empty structure to isolate the cases there that you're treating, mm-hmm. because you don't want them in the wards and other places in the hospitals and the other clinics where you're working so that you can prevent any kind of cross-infection. Mm-hmm. We are still seeing, you know, low levels of cases everywhere we're working. Certainly not at all the magnitude of what was there a few months ago, but I think there's a huge concern on everyone's part that it's now, for the most part, the dry season, and there's much less transmission, but as soon as the rainy season starts again in a month or two, there's no question that we're going to likely see a huge, well, it may not be to the magnitude of the original outbreak, but we are going to see an increase in cases. So we need to, all the teams there need to, and, you know, the sites there need to stay sort of on alert, mm-hmm. to start addressing the problem as soon as possible. I think at this point we did a lot of community distribution of water purification kits, a ton of community education, also household distribution of the sort of first-line treatment, which is with oral rehydration therapy. And so a lot of the communities are going to be ready because they've seen this already, but there'll definitely be some issues depending on how, you know, how much flooding happens, mm-hmm. What happens with the rainy season. I have to say, this is a bit maybe of speculation on my part. I haven't seen the data myself, but mm-hmm. for the most part, Port-au-Prince has been spared. I think it's there have definitely been cases there. There have been fatalities there, and there was an outbreak, but I think everyone was most concerned about people who were in the camps that still have pretty terrible access to sanitation facilities, but luckily have better access to clean water than many of the other areas that were affected by this. And we're watching closely the water distribution at any of the areas where we're working, because as soon as any of the either free or low-cost water sources that are being provided to the camps are cut off, mm-hmm. you could face some, you know, huge problems with people using, you know, non-potable, non-drinkable sources of water. So I think that's a big concern that we're trying to track at this point.
Mm-hmm. So we have you for a couple more minutes. So I just wanted mm-hmm. to, I guess, talk about long-term development in Haiti. And evidently the state of Haitian healthcare is not where it should be, at least from the government level. I know living in Canada, I've been fortunate enough to have the benefits of public health care from a centralized government that provides services to me when I require them. How do you see Haiti evolving with regards to health care, and where should it be, say, in the next 5-10 years?
Well, I think that's a great question, Russ. Let's separate water sanitation and healthcare, even though you can't with something like a cholera epidemic. But I think much will depend on the amount of resources that are available to the government, mm-hmm. To, one, strengthen the health services, and two, strengthen water and sanitation systems. A lot of commitments were made last year after the earthquake to help rebuild the country, and not just Port-au-Prince, but outside of Port-au-Prince, with improved health care facilities,
yeah.
and, and also in some cases water and sanitation facilities. So I know that the government has plans to do just that, you know, to really improve healthcare and water and sanitation services around the country. I think the question is where and when the resources will be available. To tell you the truth, I mean, we have all the donor commitments for calendar year 2010 were actually better than they've been in previous disasters in Haiti and other places around the world. I think I haven't seen data for, well, since the since around mid-January, but, you know, we were up to about 70% of the commitments had been met, and the money had been donated. But what's important is that most of that money in the initial year was still a lot related to sort of relief and recovery efforts, and now what we need to see are the follow-through on the financial commitments on the sort of reconstruction phase.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, I hate to use the word silver lining, I think that, you know, in some instances at least, there's just, you know, historically there have been a ton of water projects in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem is they're just sort of single source, single community, single village, single household sort of level interventions that are not there to build up a sort of a public or municipal supply of water. And I think that the importance of that has really been highlighted with the cholera outbreak because, as you said, you know, in Canada, here in the United States, even if we had cases of cholera, which we've had a handful here in the United States, I think maybe you guys had some in Canada too, our water supply system is such that even if it was introduced, that cholera was introduced into the, you know, sort of waste system, it wouldn't make its way into the water system. And so I think that's what we really need to be focusing on in Haiti for the, you know, next 5 to 10 years is really building up local municipal water systems that can be government managed and provide safer water supplies to the population. And I think actually, fortunately, some of the donors have actually seen the importance of this given the widespread cholera problems. But it's still, I would say we still have to wait and see whether or not the resources are going to be committed to follow through on building those systems.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the politics of disaster relief and I guess the politics surrounding Haiti is a whole other can of worms that we won't get into today.
Yeah. But, yeah. No, it's true.
Yeah. I guess lastly, I just wanted to, maybe you could tell our listeners how to find Partners in Health, maybe online, how they can donate, stuff like that.
Oh, thank you. So our website is just www.pih.org. There are donate buttons very prominently displayed on almost all the pages of the website. I think I would also highlight what is also on the website are some of our long-term plans and long-term commitments to Haiti that you can read more about the model that the partners, the approach the Partners in Health takes to working in Haiti and other countries around the world and really trying to strengthen the local systems. And we hope to have more information up there, you know, not anytime soon, but within, you know, a few months. Also on how people may be able to get more engaged in advocacy-related campaigns to support Haiti in general. And, you know, while there's some stuff up there now, I think that we're still trying to figure out ways that we can engage people not just to donate and support us, which we really appreciate, but also to take the long-term view on Haiti and how can we keep our own governments engaged in supporting Haiti, etc. So people can keep an eye out for that as well.
That's great. All right, Donna, I'd like to thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much for having me. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
All right, all the best.
All right, thank you.
And we're back. That was Donna Berry, Advocacy and Policy Director of Partners in Health. She did a really good job of discussing the various problems affecting Haitian healthcare currently. And at the end, we did touch briefly upon some of the long-term changes needed for Haitian healthcare to become self-sufficient, or in other words, for NGO services to no longer be required. Prior to the earthquake in Haiti, actually, 80% of Haiti's basic services were being provided by NGOs. Haiti is actually known as the Republic of NGOs in that there are more than 10,000 NGOs operating within it. And most are not geared towards long-term sustainable development like Partners in Health is. More operate according to the quick fix, provide a little bit of aid or a band-aid solution. So we have to ask ourselves, why is this so? In Canadian society, would we be comfortable with foreign charities providing us with education, healthcare, and other social services? Who are these organizations accountable to, anyways? Will we not question why our government is not providing these services in the first place? Now, Partners in Health is doing so much in Haiti right now, but they can't do it all. There's a requirement for aid being provided by the government in place. In Canada, for example, if there was an earthquake, our government would be providing the aid, not a foreign country, say Iran. So we have to look into the structural factors of why Haiti is unable to deal with a problem like earthquake or a problem like cholera. And I have about 2.5 minutes left, so I want to give a brief overview of why this is so and maybe direct you, our listeners, to some sources that can further elaborate upon this. So if you look at Haiti's history over the past 40 years, during the Cold War, Haiti was ruled by two dictators known as the Duvaliers. They were instated by the U.S., to fight the threat of communism and socialism in Haiti. And the Duvaliers created what is known as a kleptocracy. A small portion of Haitian society, 5%, is extremely wealthy. They control more than 50% of the country's wealth, while the other 95% is known as Haiti's poor majority. This system of disparity and creating poverty and imbalance in wealth was maintained for the past 40 years. And in 1991, Haiti underwent a democratic transition. And if you give a society like Haiti free and fair elections, with a majority of Haiti being poor, they will elect someone who represents their interests. And that's what happened in 1991. A man by the name of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a priest who believed in liberation theology, was elected. And he was immediately removed 5 months after being elected in a U.S. and Canadian-backed coup. He was returned in 1995, but not allowed to run for re-election until 2000. And in 2000, he began fighting against the economic policies in Haiti that prevent any poverty reduction from taking place. With regards to healthcare, he introduced cutting-edge AIDS programs. He began a partnership with Cuba that would allow Haitian doctors to be trained by Cuban doctors and then do work within their communities. He opened the first free medical school in Haiti. That was estimated to train 600 doctors over the next 12 years. He created a disaster relief program to deal with things like earthquakes. He even created public sanitation programs for water to catch things like cholera. But Aristide, what he did was he challenged the power disparity in Haitian society. That 5% elite saw him as a threat. The corporations in Canada and the U.S. that profit off of the disparity in Haitian society, they saw Aristide as a threat as well. So in 2004, Canadian and U.S. troops landed in Haiti and kidnapped him, exiling him to South Africa and installing another coup government that has rolled back all of these progressive social programs Aristide instituted. That water sanitation program he created, that would have caught cholera. Cholera is a disease that is very treatable. All that's required is hydration, salts and sugars, and that could have been provided easily had a centralized government been in place. So we're about out of time now, so I'll just wrap things up. If you're interested in learning more about why Haiti is in such a state of peril, I recommend Googling the Canada-Haiti Action Network. That is the largest solidarity organization in Canada that deals with some of the structural problems affecting Haiti and keeping it so poor. You can also find them online at www.canadahaitiaction.ca. There's a lot of good resources out there. So thanks for tuning in to 93.3 CFMU Radio and listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. I'm Riaz Sayani-Mulji, and I will be seeing you later.